Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. It's a glorious sunny Sunday afternoon in Maurepas, just to the south of Paris, and that was the sound of Daniel McClay of the Bretan Séché team rolling out of the start house for the Prologue time trial, 6 or so kilometres around the streets of Maurepas, that kicks off the 2015 Paris-Nice.
And directly to the front, eh? You can do the final.
You have to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, you're not in the race.
Is it a little bit uncomfortable that you've got guys that people say, we don't really like the fact that you've got this ex-doper on your team and so on and so forth? Yes, that's extremely uncomfortable.
I'm very busy, but I always find a little bit of time for our listeners, for you.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
So I'm covering Paris-Nice solo this week. I'm not with Richard Moore or Daniel Freeb, who would usually be travelling with me on the Tour de France. Richard is back in London working on plans for the next special episode of the podcast for people who have signed up to the Friends of the Podcast scheme. And if you haven't signed up yet, we'd really like you to. It's £5 for the whole year. That will give you 11 special episodes of the podcast, which only Friends of the Podcast can listen to. The first special episode was released a few weeks ago, looking back at the first 5 years of Team Sky, and the second special episode will be released in a couple of weeks, and Richard's working on that at the moment. And Daniel is off on a now not so secret mission in the United States, and the reason it's not so secret is because Lance Armstrong couldn't resist tweeting that he'd beaten Daniel at golf, and knowing how seriously Daniel takes golf, I'm not sure how he'll be feeling about that. Anyway, I'm here at Paris-Nice, and the idea generally was to try and produce an episode that's a bit of a road trip from Maurepas, where the race started on Sunday, down to the Côte d'Azur. Of course, we release our episodes on a Thursday, and the race will only have reached the halfway mark by that point. And really, the publication of the CERC report, Cycling's Independent Reform Commission report into the UCI and anti-doping efforts, has really sort of thrown out those original plans, because I managed to get an exclusive interview for the podcast with Team Sky's principal, Dave Brailsford. We didn't actually intend to put all 40 minutes of that interview out, but then when we listened back to it, we thought the best thing to do, perhaps the most revealing and enlightening thing to do, and to give the context to what are quite complex issues, we decided that the best thing to do would be to put that all out so everybody could hear what Dave Brailsford had to say. So if you want to listen to that, it's available on iTunes or SoundCloud or Audioboom or various podcast catching apps, and it's episode number 7. This is episode number 8 of 2015, and it's going to be all about Paris-Nice. What have we got coming up? Well, we've got a bit of Bradley Wiggins talking about riding his final edition of this race. We've got Sean Kelly's favourite memories of Paris-Nice. He is really Monsieur Paris-Nice, having won the race 7 times in a row in the 80s. And we'll also be deciding definitively which is the best spring stage race, Paris-Nice or its Italian counterpart, Tirreno Adriatico. And in true cycling tradition, we have conducted the most far-reaching research in order to come up with the definitive answer to that question. So you'll hear all of that a bit later on in the show, but first, here's a roundup of the week's news. It's been a very busy week in cycling. Paris-Nice got underway, of course, and you'll hear a bit more about that in this episode. Tirreno Adriatico just about getting underway as I'm recording this now, and at the weekend just gone, ZNX Stibar of the Etix Quickstep team won the Strada Bianchi race on the white dusty roads of Tuscany. Very impressive victory, outfoxing Alejandro Valverde among others to win that. But it's not all been great news for Etix Quickstep, because Tom Boonen crashed earlier on in Paris-Nice. He touched his teammate Nicolas Meiss's wheel, went down. Early reports were that he'd broken a collarbone, but it seems like it's a separated shoulder. Either way, he's definitely out of the Cobble Classics, which is a real shame. And of course, as I mentioned, the CERC report was released. The headline that grabbed most of the attention was the anonymous statement that 90% of the current peloton are doping, a statement that wasn't attributed to anybody and wasn't backed up with any kind of facts. So we will no doubt debate that report in full in a later episode of the podcast. It's going to be far more enlightening, I think, if we debate that amongst ourselves with Richard and Daniel here. Another reminder that the Dave Brailsford exclusive interview is available to listen to if you want to hear his reactions to the publication of the report. And of course, cycling wouldn't be cycling without the sport managing to shoot itself in one foot and then in the other. Lloyd Mondori of the AG2R team tested positive for EPO on the eve of Tirreno Adriatico and of course has been removed from that race. And the racing is underway in Paris-Nice and in Italy. As it stands at the moment, Michael Matthews of the Orica Green Edge team is in the lead as yellow jersey here at Paris-Nice, having won stage 3 to Saint-Pourçain-sur-Sioule. So that's the week in cycling.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Well, it's time for another of Lionel's lectures, this time talking about Paris-Nice. Paris-Nice, otherwise known as La Course au Soleil, or the Race to the Sun, was first held in 1933. Like so many other bike races, it was founded to promote newspapers, in this case the Parisienne Le Petit Journal and the Nice-based Le Petit Nice. Paris-Nice earned its nickname because it's held in March and the journey south takes the riders towards the Côte d'Azur and the sunshine. However, the weather can be variable, and the big mountains are avoided because roads can still be covered with snow. For many years, the race director was a man called Jean Luliot, and when he passed away in the early 1980s, his daughter Josette took over running the race. In the year 2000, Laurent Fignon, the two-time Tour de France winner, bought the event, but this coincided with a very difficult time commercially, and after just 2 years, he sold it on to ASO, the owners of the Tour de France. It could be argued that they saved the event. ASO has since imposed its mark. For many years, the leader's jersey was white, but when the company took over in 2002, virtually the first thing they did was to change the jersey to a yellow and white mix, and in 2008, they went the whole hog and made it into a yellow jersey, just like the Tour de France. The race generally starts in or around Paris, although in 1982 it started from just inside Belgium, on the border with northeastern France. The distinguishing feature of the event is undoubtedly the Col d'Aise, a gradual climb that goes out of the back of the city and looks out over the Mediterranean. The first time trial stage on the Col d'Aise was held in 1968, and Eddy Merckx and Ramon Poulidor took turns winning in those early years. Ireland's Sean Kelly, the man who won a record 7 editions of Paris-Nice between 1982 and 1988, often clinched his overall victories on the Col. In 1996, the Col d'Aise time trial was left off the menu after many years. Instead, they've had sprint finishes on the Promenade des Anglais or sometimes a time trial on the flat roads of Nice. But in 2005, a new final stage tradition was established, with a road stage going over the Col de la Porte, La Turbie and the Col d'Aise. But in 2012, the famous time trial returned, and on that occasion, Bradley Wiggins won the race overall, defeating Louis Westra. Wiggins became the second British rider to win the race after Tom Simpson in 1967. The reigning champion is Carlos Betancourt, who became the first Colombian winner last year, although this time he's riding Tirreno Adriatico over in Italy. So that's all you need to know about Paris-Nice.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
Bradley Wiggins, a 2012 winner of Paris-Nice, is riding the event this week for the last time in his career. It's also one of the last major stage races that he's riding for Team Sky before he switches across to Team Wiggins, the development squad that he's had a hand in setting up, which he hopes will help nurture young British riders. I caught up with Bradley at the start of one of the stages of Paris-Nice. It was right next to the start line, and there was only a few minutes to go until the start, so in the background there is the commentary from the public address system, but hopefully you'll be able to hear Bradley nice and clearly. Brad, how does it feel this week riding your last Paris-Nice? You rode this, I think, for the first time in maybe 2003. Is it a bit surreal?
Yeah, a little bit, I guess. I was talking to Chavanel about it yesterday when we were riding along, about because we were riding really easy. And I was saying it's not like it used to be, this race. But I remember riding it with sort of Tyler Hamilton's, Floyd Landis's and Frank Vandenbroek and all that. You know, it was like used to be the hardest week of your life. Well, it was for me at that time. Coming back as like an ex-winner as well, and and being here, not having a lot of pressure on me, like days like today, not having to sort of make sure you don't get a split in the final, and doing that now for Richie and G, it's kind of a nice way as well, because it's just you can enjoy it a bit more. It's not as stressful.
In terms of the history of the race, I mean, you're kind of a keen student of cycling. You remember Sean Kelly winning on the Col d'Huez and all of that. So did it have a sort of special place for you, particularly as you won it a few years ago as well?
I think that was the biggest thing for me when I won it, was had been the first British winner since Tom won it. I think that is, you know, and when I finished third as well, I thought if I never go on to do anything else in the race, I've always sort of equaled Boardman's 96 third. And so just, and I obviously just remember those distinctly as a kid, watching Boardman winning down the promenade in the last time trial and those sort of things. So it's, yeah, I think that's important to me, because I feel like you put your name in history with those guys. So
what did it mean to the French riders? You've ridden on three French teams, Française des Jeux, Crédit Agricole and Cofidis. Was it a big, big week for them?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's... I remember being pro, first turning pro with Française des Jeux, and it was all they spoke. It was like the first big rendezvous, you used to say. You know, it was kind of Paris-Nice was at that time. Fignon was the organizer. It was everything, really. Just it was almost like a selection of the tour team. You know, they didn't put guys in just for experience. It was renowned as the closest thing you'd get to the Tour de France sprint finishes or anything like that. So, you know, just to make the team was something, as the tour is these days.
You rode the prologue, obviously, in the rainbow jersey, but to ride on the Col d'Huez in the rainbow jersey, that must be something to look forward to.
Yeah, I think it's going to be raining as well, which is a bit shit, but yeah, I mean, it is just to be in the rainbow jersey, you know, in any time trial this year has been an honour. But I think to be able to ride Col d'Huez, I'm 6 kilos heavier than when I won it, so I'm not going to be up there this year, but challenging for the win. But it'll be nice to do that and just be able to give it. It's my last at this level anyway. I know I'm doing Tour of Yorkshire, but this is Paris-Nice. You know, this is such a historic race.
Bradley Wiggins won Paris-Nice once in his career. Sean Kelly, the Irishman, is the holder of the record. He won it 7 years in a row from 1982 to 1988. And I caught up with him to ask him for his favourite memories of those victories. This is his favourite memory. Sean, tell me about the 1982 Paris-Nice, your first victory. You go to the final time trial on the Col d'Huez, in with a shout. It's been a close battle with Gilbert Duclos-Lazalle, and you've got Jean de Gribaldi, the legendary director sportif, willing you on all the way. But tell me about how you got into a position to win the race.
Well, I think it was something that was coming for a number of months, many months before, because de Gribaldi, he had been working with me and saying that, yes, I could win a Paris-Nice. And always with a bike rather, when you haven't, you know, actually achieved it, there's a bit of doubt in your mind. And it was a very closely contested race in the final number of days. The stage on the Saturday to Mondelou, which was the descent into Mondelou. I actually attacked Duclos-Lazalle, crashed on a corner, and then lost a bit of time, but you know, got back on my bike and limited my losses and went to the final time trial. In with a shout to take the victory in Paris-Nice, but of course it was all something new to me, trying to win the race, a time trial to win a Paris-Nice. There was, you know, a lot of nervousness there. And de Gribaldi was saying, yes, you can do it. Duclos-Lazalle is not as good as time trialing, and, you know, he doesn't climb as well as you. So it was, very nerve-wracking moment. Or more than moments, let's say, you know, hours before the Saturday night, the Sunday, of course, before the actual time trial itself. And then set off in the time trial and... pretty much on the limit in the time trial, and de Gribaldi is saying every time I was sitting in the saddle, he was saying, you know, debout, you know, get out of the saddle. So it was, I can still feel the pain of that time trial to this day.
On the descent to Mondelou, when you attacked, is it right that Gilbert Duclos-Lazalle came past you while you were on the ground and you were limiting your losses?
Yes, well, I had attacked on the descent and I took a little bit of an advantage, 50, 80 metres. Then I slid on a corner, went down, And I was just, you know, about to pick myself up when Duke Law went flying by. And luckily my bike, I had no damage mechanically, no damage major to myself except for some road rash. So, you know, got back on my bike pretty quickly and, you know, finished just a number of seconds behind him. And, you know, so I was definitely in with, you know, with a shout to challenge for overall victory going for the time trial up the Col d'Aise on the final stage.
And on the Saturday night, and even on the Sunday with the split stage, wasn't it? Was Jean de Gribaldi keeping a really close eye on what you had for dinner on the Saturday night? His belief was always on staying light, making sure you didn't weigh yourself down with too much food.
Well, it wasn't only when you were in tension for a Paris-Nice that de Gribaldi was looking over your shoulder, breakfast, dinner, all the time. And he certainly was, you know, on it big time on that Saturday night. You know, to make sure you don't eat too much, that was always his words, you know. You only need to eat little because eating too much, it just puts more pressure on the body to digest it and all of that scenario.
And so on the Col d'Aise, was it a climb you knew well? Did you practice on it beforehand?
No, I hadn't practiced on beforehand. I had seen the Col d'Aise before, of course, and before the actual time trial itself, I went and rode up the climb in the earlier part of the afternoon. But again, you know, until you actually go out and experience in competition, and in competition when you're fighting to win a Paris-Nice and your first Paris-Nice, you know, that is very intimidating times. And, you know, the nerves before the time trial, I probably went to the toilet 3-4 times.
More detail than we need there, Sean. But Duke Lozal had won it before a couple of years earlier, hadn't he? So he knew what it was like to win on the Col d'Aise. Do you think you needed de Gribaldi shouting at you out of the car window pretty much all the way up the 11-kilometre climb?
Yes, well, I think that it always helps. You know, when you're on the limit, on the river in bike terms, and you know you're out of the saddle for, you know, 50, 60 metres, then you sit down for a moment, and it only feels like a 2.5 second sit in the saddle, and you get the shout again. You know, out of the saddle, to boo, and not only from de Gribaldi, it was from the mechanic also, Jackie. You know, and you just you stay sitting for, you know, another 2 seconds, 3 seconds, then you have to get out because you feel, you know, you're not doing what they want you to do, or not giving your best. So, you know, that time trial, I really went deep, and that's what you've got to do in time trial. But it's an experience you have to, you know, be true. And when you can push the body to that extent, well, then the following times and next times, you know how much you have to push the body and push the pain barrier.
Were you seeing stars or anything like that when you got to the finish? Were you in real oxygen debt? We know, was it the furthest you pushed yourself in your career at that point?
Yes, by far. It was by far my, you know, the time trial where I went so deep, pushed myself to, you know, to the limit. And, you know, I can remember, you know, there was times there where you see it, you know, it's a little bit hazy in front of you because you're in the final kilometres, because it was a one I wasn't sure exactly how much I was up on him. I knew I was up a little bit, so in the final kilometres I really had to give it, you know, my 100%, and, you know, I finished totally empty.
We'll hear more of Sean's memories from Paris-Nice a little bit later on.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
It's now Tuesday late afternoon. I've been joined by Rob Hatch, the commentator for British Eurosport, working here on the race this year with co-commentator Sean Kelly. Rob, hello.
Hello, Lionel. Now, we're at Paris-Nice, and that's all I'm going to say, because in true tradition of the podcast, Rich is not here. I'm going to have to say it. Lionel, where are we?
Making a play to become a regular on the team here, Rob. I'm not sure the other two are going to like that too much. We are in Saint-Amand-Montrond. We're a couple of days south of Paris now, aren't we? Heading towards the centre, bang in the centre of France. It always reminds me here of the Tour de France, because the Tour comes here semi-regularly. 2008, there was the final time trial here when Cadel Evans tried and failed to overhaul Carlos Sastre, who eventually won that Tour. And then it was the famous stage of the crosswinds, 2013, where Saxo as they were then, Tinkoff Saxo now, they took advantage of a bit of inattention from Team Sky. A real fantastic day's racing that was. Just remember being sort of gripped watching it on the TV and then rushing out to where all the team buses were parked and just getting all of those different accounts of what had happened on the road that day. And of course everybody had a different story. Perhaps not the most action-packed of stages today. Stage 2 of Paris-Nice, won by André Greipel, the German champion. Another sprint stage. From your point of view, Rob, the two road stages so far, have they been a bit of a challenge? Because they haven't exactly lit up the screen as yet.
From my point of view, yeah, thankfully. Obviously, I can rely on seven-time winner Monsieur Paris-Nice Sean Kelly to talk me through the past and fill in the gaps in my little knowledge. Of course, I wasn't really around. Certainly, I wasn't watching bike racing or watching anything back then. But he's not that young.
Don't kid us. You're not that young.
He's been telling me about, you know, the differences between now and his day. And yeah, we've had a lot of time to talk about that because we've had two really flat stages, nothing really going on. A couple of token climbs for the organisers, third category climbs, which really, I mean, today's was a proper climb. It was 2 kilometres long, it was 5%, but yesterday it was nothing but a lump and bump outside of Paris. And it was to get the sponsors involved and get the polka dot jersey on the back of Jonathan Hivert, who's kept that after 2 days. You said that André Greipel won the stage today. It was Alexander Kristoff winning the stage on stage one proper, and that is after Mikhail Kwiatkowski, the world champion, had won the opening prologue. He's just about kept the yellow jersey, but the only thing that really has been interesting in terms of the racing, apart from the sprinting, has been the hunt for bonus seconds. And it's normally something we see on Paris-Nice. We certainly saw it last year with that experimental route and lack of time trialing and climbing and what have you. But John Degenkolb's really going for it. He started this week after the prologue. I think he was 10 or 9 seconds back. He's down to 2 seconds now, and he could take the yellow jersey going on through the week. One more sprinter's day left, so it'd be a worthy wearer of it because he's worked hard for it. And yeah, it hasn't been the easiest race to watch, but we've had plenty to talk about in the world of cycling as usual, as those of you been watching on Eurosport will know.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You're alluding there to the CIRC report, Cycling's Independent Reform Commission, which published their report on Sunday. A lot of reaction to that, of course. And the Cycling Podcast got in on the act with an exclusive interview with Dave Brailsford, in which he gave his full thoughts about the report and made some really quite interesting suggestions for where cycling can go from here. But in terms of Paris-Nice and the racing, obviously the organisers coming across these flat plains, they were hoping that we'd get some spring crosswinds and that they would really break up, and it could have been absolutely dramatic.
Yeah, that was the idea behind the design, and we've had a lot of people tweeting in hashtag home of cycling, of course, at Eurosport, and asking us, well, why are they going slow, what's happening? And surely people were saying, well, they could take a leaf out of the Tour Down Under's book. Now these guys know what they're doing. They put these courses together. You know, you've got the tour director Christian Prudhomme, and if you look at the Tour de France they've put together this year, they're hoping it's going to be windy again there, certainly off the North Sea and the Channel. There's potential for absolute chaos there, just as there was here. And again, talking to Sean Kelly throughout the first couple of stages, he was saying, well, yep, he's been involved in real crosswind fights here. He talked about the Tour de France stage here, and that's what the French media were talking about this morning. They wanted that to happen again. If you looked at the top 10 that day, you had Mark Cavendish winning the stage, second place Peter Sagan, after that Bauke Mollema, and the rest of the GC contenders. I think Alberto Contador, correct me if I'm right, it might well be 6th or 7th he came. He was certainly in the top 10, a lot of GC contenders, and it was one of the most extraordinary top 10s of a stage won by a sprinter that I think you're likely to see. So they hope for a bit more of that, but we stand talking just after the finish and the flagpoles aren't even moving still.
No, it is a nice afternoon here. I'm actually wearing a T-shirt, which after the grim winter we've had in Britain, it's just nice to feel a little bit of sunshine, a little bit of warmth. It was cool and overcast and a bit drizzly this morning. The stage started at a zoo, which was a little bit surreal. Paris-Nice, of course, you know, people do often talk about race design as if it's something you can just sort of pluck from the air and you could put a mountain stage in on stage two. But of course the race is called Paris-Nice. It has to go from, broadly speaking, Paris down to Nice in 8 days. You can't suddenly divert it over into really mountainous terrain, and even if they did, you know, you could get caught out with the weather another way, with the passes being closed, so they can't particularly go very high. So in order to try and enliven the early stages of the race, they're hoping that the wind would blow, and of course it didn't happen today. But that doesn't mean we didn't have an interesting run-in, because there was that really stellar group that got away in the last 10 kilometres. Tony Martin kicked it off. Unusual, really, to see a rider who's on the team defending the leader's jersey, yeah, actually make an aggressive move like that.
It was, but again, if Tony Martin was at 7 seconds, so if he'd have got away and won the stage, or picked up some bonus seconds, been in a group with the likes of Thomas and Bowman, who was with, there's a real chance that he was going to keep the yellow jersey in the team. He is, of course, a former winner of Paris-Nice, but a Paris-Nice that probably didn't include a mountain stage, very much like the one it has this week, of course. And having said that, though, you've still got two time trials where you could take a lot of time out of everybody else. That's what makes it such an interesting race. I said right at the start, it's a race that's won and lost on seconds, bonus seconds sometimes, and with the time trials still to come, it could be interesting. But talking of time trials, they did nearly time trial themselves to the finish. They were away for a while, they got caught within the last couple of kilometres, and it was only really thanks to the work of Lotto Soudal, the team of the winner Andre Greipel, which made it satisfying, I think, to watch from a fan's point of view. And Orica Greenedge, who wanted to make it interesting and try and get Michael Matthews in. He finished fourth as well, so in the end, a good day. And I think one more little thing to pick up from the sprint today, good news for French fans, because Arnaud Démare finally showed himself after the Middle Eastern races where he was hiding away. He was second, a very close second to Andre Greipel, and Greipel had only won once in the Algarve as well, so good to see those big popular sprinters getting up there and getting some glory themselves.
Well, I know Daniel will be very pleased to see a showdown eventually between Arnaud Démare and Nasser Bouhanni. Of course, he's moved away from Démare's Française des Jeux team, or FDJ team, into Cofidis. Potential for a sort of French showdown in the sprints there later on in the season, perhaps even here this week. Just switching subjects a little bit, because we've got Tirreno Adriatico starting as well. The two big spring stage races, World Tour events overlapping, of course, so it divides our attention. You know, Eurosport has to try and find space to put both races on, and when I've not been covering one or the other, you have to watch the end of one and then switch over. They do try and stagger it so that people can watch the last hour of one and switch over. But I've been here conducting my own independent commission report. Ooh. Very scientific survey. I wanted to find out from the riders themselves which of the two events is the best, Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico. So a hugely scientific survey of three riders. So I'm going to ask Bram Tankink of the Team Lotto NL Jumbo squad which of the two big spring stage races he prefers, Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico. Bram's been a professional a number of years and has ridden both events. So first up, do you get the choice of which race you do between Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico, or does the team decide?
Yeah, in this case, the team decides where they want to have the classic riders, or where they need the help of some riders of the team. Like normally, I did a lot of years, I did a Tirreno, and now I do Paris-Nice to help Wilco in the mountains.
So you're on Wilco Kelderman duty this week?
Yeah.
So normally, which course do you prefer, Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico in a normal year?
I don't really care. For me, it's the same. It's both suffering. It's both really hard. They have almost the same profiles, like some uphill finishes, some hard stages. Before Tirreno was more easy, but they made it really hard last year. Before Tirreno was normally a little better weather, but last year, the climate change makes Italy very wet, so they have a lot of wet days in Tirreno as well. So
a road is a road, whether it's in France or Italy for you when you're working.
Exactly.
Okay, so which race has the best hotels and the best food for you as riders?
The food definitely was the best in Italy, that's for sure, but we have a cook.
So you have a chef with the team?
Chef with the team. In France, so the hotels are pretty much the same.
For preparation for Milan-San Remo particularly, which event do you think is the best? Because we always see the winner of Milan-San Remo and we look back and see, did they ride Paris-Nice or did they ride Tirreno? But for Milan-San Remo, which is the best?
The statistics say it's Tirreno, but it really depends where the strongest riders are. Now almost the same race, when it turned pro tour, so I think it doesn't really matter if you do Tirreno or Paris-Nice. It really depends probably on the weather you have in one of those races, and that's all.
So the weather makes a difference. Lastly then, if I could give you €1 million and you had to choose one race, Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico, which one would get your verdict?
Paris-Nice with a lot of wind.
So that's 1-0 to Paris-Nice, an emphatic early lead for the French stage race. The Italian counterpart not getting a look in, but what does the Australian road champion Heinrich Hausler think is the best of the two events?
I like Paris better, definitely. I've only ridden Torino once, but didn't have such a good experience, so just go with Paris.
What was the bad experience in Torino?
Long stage races, you know, pretty slow all day and then hard in the final, uphill finish and stuff. I mean, the first two stages here have been pretty similar, so. But normally here in France, just it's a French style of racing. It's just hard and full gas all day.
In terms of hotels and the food, Italy or France?
Italy.
So that's one for in Torino's favour.
Yeah.
And in terms of preparing for Milan-San Remo, which is the first big hard classic, do you think Paris-Nice or Torino is the most ideal for the big guys?
It depends really on what kind of rider you are. But I mean, you can't really say. I mean, you know, winners come from Paris-Nice and also from Torino, so personal choice.
And lastly then, if you had to come down on the side of one or the other, for you, which is the best race?
From Paris-Nice and Torino? Yeah, Paris-Nice. That's why I'm here.
That settles it then. 2-0 to Paris-Nice, and the peloton has spoken. A 428-page report confirming these findings will be published in due course. But perhaps we ought to give Tirreno Adriatico a chance and ask another rider which of the two races he prefers. And so I've caught up with Matty Breschel, who has every reason to dislike Paris-Nice, because on stage two, he got into the break with Geraint Thomas, Tony Martin, Lars Boom, and he had a mechanical problem and was unable to contribute further to the break and lost out on what might have been an outside chance of a stage win. Perhaps if he'd been up there, they'd have had the horsepower to stay away from the peloton. Anyway, here is Matty Breschel. Okay, Matty, yesterday you were looking very strong. You got into a very good-looking break with some very powerful riders, Geraint Thomas, Lars Boom, Tony Martin, of course, and it was all looking so good. And then disaster struck. Can you explain to us what happened?
Yeah, well, I had some problems during the race, just before I went. I don't know, I went in a hole and my chain fell off. And when I put it back on, I bended the chain ring a little bit. And then it was just every time I went too hard, it kind of wanted to come off. And it's really, really dangerous.
So was it skipping a little bit? Was it jumping sometimes when you were putting effort on?
Yeah.
So obviously then you had to stop and that was your chance gone. But obviously the legs were feeling good.
Yeah, it's okay. It's always a bit weird when we had some really easy days. And of course the finals are hard and difficult and really stressful. But yeah, it was nice to get out there just to open up the whole system again.
Is it a little frustrating when it's so it was so tranquilo on those first two stages? There was, you know, a very relaxed feeling in the peloton. Nobody really wanted to make the pace hard. And at this time of year, do you not need harder racing for a longer period of time?
Yeah, maybe, but it is how it is. You know, there's no other races, so.
Well, funnily enough, I've been asking other riders which of the two stage races they prefer between Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. Yeah. You're an experienced guy. You've ridden both. For you, which is the best one?
I live in Italy. I love Italy. So, of course, I'd rather do that race. But, again, Paris-Nice is a beautiful race as well. And probably fits me better. Give me more chances, probably, because Tirreno is getting harder and harder.
Is it nice when you finally see the sea at the end of the week?
Yeah.
Certainly is for us, and obviously it's called the Race to the Sun. The weather hasn't been too bad this week, but when you get a bit of sunshine on your back, the morale comes up.
Yeah, of course. You always get a bit depressed when you don't see the sun.
So Breschel gives a late consolation goal for Tirreno Adriatico, but still a convincing 2-1 win for Paris-Nice. The confirmed result is that Paris-Nice is better than Tirreno Adriatico, which I'm pretty sure everyone can agree with. Next up, we've got Sean Kelly again talking about his favourite memories from his time as the man who was dominating Paris-Nice in the 80s. Sean, The 1983 Paris-Nice was a little bit more straightforward. You were riding for the SEM team and you had two teammates on the podium with you, Jean-Marie Grezet and Stephen Rooks, the Dutchman, not to be confused with Stephen Roach, the Irishman. We'll come to him in a minute. And you said that the most eventful thing about that race was keeping an eye on your teammates, making sure they didn't give you the jump. 1984, 85, 86, you continued this run of victories. You beat Stephen Roach relatively comfortably a couple of times, but it was the 1987 race where it looked like your run was coming to a finish. Stephen Roach had taken the white jersey. The leader's jersey in those days was white, not yellow as it is today, and he looked like he had victory wrapped up until you climbed the Col de Vence on the penultimate day, I think it was. Sean, tell us a story.
Well, Roachy was going real well that season. He had a good start. He had some wins under his belt before the Paris-Nice, so he was always going to be a difficult one to beat. I knew that starting out in Paris-Nice, and as the race went on, I could see it more clearly that he was going to be a difficult one to break. And going into the penultimate stage, which was on the Sunday morning, around 100 kilometres, maybe 110 kilometre stage, but a very difficult stage because, you know, we started out of Nice and went inland, so there was a lot of climbing right from the start. And the tactic was within my team that we would try and make the race difficult because there was time bonifications at the finish for the first three riders. So to get rid of all the sprinters, and then I might be able to get some of the time bonifications if I get the stage victory, well, then that would be of major importance for me to challenge Roach for the overall win of Paris-Nice on the final climb up Col d'Aise. And of course, we were riding, we had Van den Broek, we had Gaston, we had a lot of other riders who rode very, very early, and we were climbing Col de Vence, and I remember Gaston, he was, you know, riding real strong. Van den Broek was exceptional on that day, and we maybe had 20, 25 riders left. And as we got to the top of Col de Vence, it was snow on the road, and they had put some grit, sand on it, and then maybe a couple of hundred metres before the summit, I had this puncture. And I did not look around, but Van den Broek looked around. He said to me, he said, "C'est Roche." So immediately he upped the pace by 5 kilometres an hour. I didn't have to say anything, but yes, it was what I wanted. And then, yeah, we made a descent full on. And when we got down in the valley, there was a lot of other riders. You know, there was Motet, there was Fignon, there was a lot of other riders who started riding as well, and that helped our situation. And of course, Roach lost the overall, and at the finish, a lot of discussion. But yeah, it was a situation, you know, we had to continue because we had been riding all day. Let's not forget that. And that's something, you know, maybe is not aired on all talk on this maybe call the controversy Paris-Nice.
Well, you say there was some discussion at the finish between yourself and Stephen Roach. The unwritten rule in cycling is you don't attack the leader of the race when they have a mechanical problem or when they have a crash. But the distinction here for you, you're very clear, is that you were already, your CAS team was already riding, setting a hard tempo all the way up the climb. What were the options open to you? Slow down and wait for Roach or push on?
Well, yes, the option was, yes, to slow down and wait. But at that point in the race, as you know, has been seen, we were riding for, you know, many kilometres, you know, 50, 60, 70 kilometres before to make the race difficult for everybody. So, yeah, it was a situation where, you know, you really had to carry on, although I accept that we did up the pace a bit, which is normal at that point of the race because we're in within 20, 25 kilometres of the finish. And yeah, if we stop riding, well, then the press would say, okay, yeah, you're riding for Roach here, you're just helping him to win the race. So it was a no-win situation, and for me the best one was to continue and try and win the race.
So what was the nature of the discussions? Did he have a word with you at the finish of the road stage, or did he say anything on the podium after you'd clinched the overall victory?
No, there was a lot of discussion after the actual stage finished that morning, and more so some of Roach's team were, you know, saying to the press that, you know, it wasn't right that they attacked him. But yeah, I always said, it was a situation where we had been controlling the race and making the race difficult. So, you know, we just continued. Maybe at that moment, I did not really say that we upped the pace a bit. That came a couple of years later. But, you know, it's an understanding within cycling from as many years as I can remember. When the race is on and there's a mechanical problem, well, then the race continues.
And so you clinched that victory there and kept the run going. And then in 1988, the run came to an end with a seventh consecutive victory. But the reason the run came to the end was because in 1989 you moved to the PDM team and you had the option not to ride Paris-Nice. So what was it that persuaded you that you should do Tirreno Adriatico in Italy instead?
Afraid of losing.
Because, well, you knew the run can't go on forever, so you might as well bow out at the top.
Yes, well, I was certainly, you know, getting concerned about, you know, not being able to continue to win, and it's normal, it's going to come, and I knew that that day was coming. But I think 88, it was a nice victory for me, because after beating Roach in the circumstances in 87, you know, I went back and won it for another time, and then I proved, well, you know, I didn't beat Roach because of heat puncturing. I was still capable of winning the Paris-Nice. But I was happy when I won that seventh one, and then situation started to change. Cass team stopping and going to PDM, and they said, you know, the Torino Adriatico would be the race that they would like to go to. And of course, I was immediately agreeing to that, because I wanted to get away from Paris-Nice, because I knew the time was coming where I was going to lose my title.
Should just clarify for newer listeners or people who are newer to the sport, back in those days, the top teams didn't put a team into both Paris-Nice or Torino Adriatico. They would choose one over the other, wouldn't they? It wouldn't necessarily go to both races.
Yes, that was the case. You know, the teams, they just would have a team fielded in one of those races. And as I said, yes, PDM, the programme was Torino Adriatico.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Sean Kelly's favourite memories there. Well, before the end of the episode, I headed out onto the road to watch the race, as any fan does, by the roadside, behind the barriers, just near the finish in Saint-Pourçain-sur-Sioule. It's Wednesday afternoon. I'm on the final climb, around about halfway up, a couple of hundred metres from the finish line. The three breakaway riders are coming past now. That's Florian Vachon, Thomas Vauclair and Philippe Gilbert, all looking pretty comfortable. They're going to go up to the finish line, and they'll have 19.5 kilometres to go once they go through the finish line. Another little lap out into the countryside to come. I've set the stopwatch running to see what the time is to the peloton. A bit like the old days of covering bike races, standing by the side of the road with a stopwatch, trying to gather information about how the race has gone. That leading trio, including the former world champion Philippe Gilbert and multi-tour stage winner Thomas Vauclair, has been away much of the day. They've had a healthy lead throughout the day. Just over 30 seconds they've got as an advantage, and the peloton comes around the bottom corner, and they're really going hard, led by Etics Quickstep. Mikhail Kwiatkowski well placed at the front of the bunch. The peloton all together. Quite an impressive sight there. Everyone out of the saddle sprinting up the hill. It levels out a bit at the top as they go around the corner there. Now comes a convoy of cars. So now I'll have to wait for however long it's going to take them to do 19.5 kilometres. No big screen for me to watch here, so I'm going to have to rely on Twitter for updates. But my suspicion is the leading trio's time out in front is numbered, limited to say the least. They'll be caught for sure. And then the final time up the climb will be interesting, because it's one of those ones where it's all about timing the effort and getting the sprint absolutely right. More and more of the race motorbikes coming past now, which indicates that the riders can't be very far away. These are, some of them are gendarmerie, the police motorbikes, making sure the road is completely clear of all traffic and spectators. I'm behind a barrier here on the climb. The other motorbikes will be carrying the press photographers, who will be racing up to the finish line, dismounting and getting into position to take their shots of the sprint finish. So the riders can't be more than a couple of minutes away now. Here comes the yellow Mavic neutral service car, complete with Mavic wheels and yellow Mavic bike. Never seems to do too much business during the race, because obviously every rider is given service by their own team car and gets their own wheels and their own spare bikes. But that means the bunch must be seconds away now. That, here comes, I think, the chief commissaire's car, a red Skoda. More motorbikes. And here's the first rider in sight. They're coming up the side of the road closest to me, so I'm going to have to stand back. It's Orica Greenedge giving it full gas on the front for Michael Matthews. Anyone this far back now is already out of it, sprinting for the minor places. Richie Port's just gone past, not going to lose any time. And a few of the riders here at the back sitting up and just coasting in, quite understandably, including one of the Sky riders there, who's obviously done his work for the day. And here goes Thomas Vauclair and Bradley Wiggins on Vauclair's wheel, just drifting off the back of the main peloton, saving their legs for another day. Vauclair, of course, has spent much of the time out in front, and there's a few stragglers caught in amongst the team cars. But I, of course, have no idea who's won the stage or whether Mikko Kwiatkowski's kept the yellow jersey, so I'm going to have to walk up to the finish line and find out the answer to that. Well, Orica Greenedge got their lead out spot on for Michael Matthews there. As they came past me, they had three or possibly four guys on the front leading Matthews out, and he obviously finished it off with a victory that also gives him the yellow jersey. Mikko Kwiatkowski, who has held that yellow jersey by the slenderest of margins over Rowan Dennis since the prologue on Sunday, he's lost that by a single second to Michael Matthews, the Australian. It remains to be seen whether Matthews can keep that jersey tomorrow. That's Thursday's stage to the Croix de Chauberet just outside Saint-Étienne. My feeling is that that's very unlikely, and that's when the race really hots up. The first big mountain, in fact the biggest of the climbs on the agenda this week, is the Croix de Chauberet on stage 4, and then the weekend down on the Côte d'Azur, and the traditional final time trial on the Col d'Aise will decide the race. It's still very close, only 14 or 15 seconds are covering the top 10. Michael Matthews is just making his way to the podium now to collect the flowers for his stage victory and then the yellow jersey as overall leader. So, having written Michael Matthews off for any hope of keeping the yellow jersey here in Paris-Nice on Thursday's stage to the Croix de Chauberet, I asked him how he was going to approach the climb, and he reminded me that he'd won a stage of the Giro at Monte Cassino, which was a hard finish, perhaps not quite as hard as the Croix de Chauberet, but he was hoping to keep the jersey.
I don't know the climb personally, but I'm thinking it's something like the stage in the Giro, the Monte Cassino stage that I won, so I'm sort of going into it with that same expectation that it's going to be the same as this, and yeah, for sure I'll go for to try and keep the yellow jersey, and if it's possible to stay with the climbers on the climb, I'll try and go for the stage too. But yeah, I just got to play it by ear because I don't really know the climb, so I'll just go into it with an open mind and see what I can do. And if it's too hard, then it's too hard. But I'll for sure go 110% for the stage.
Well, after the Michael Matthews press conference, I bumped into Sean Kelly and Rob Hatch, the British Eurosport commentary team, of course, and we just had a quick chat. And I asked Sean whether he gave Michael Matthews any hope of keeping the yellow jersey on the Croix de Chauberet. He was doubtful as well, so I don't feel so bad now. That is about it for this episode of the Cycling Podcast. The Paris-Nice race will continue on, and I'll be following it down to Nice over the next 4 days. And we'll wrap up exactly what happens in next week's episode. But for this week, a big thank you to our two sponsors, British Eurosport and Van Dessel Cycles. And Richard and Daniel will be back with me next week. And so from the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.